The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to imagine, the will to get things done. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. We're going to be talking to Jesse Burton. Jesse is a researcher at UCT into energy systems. And so we're going to talk all about coal tonight and whether or not there is any kind of future for the stuff other than leaving it in the under the ground and just letting it molder away there for eternity. Hilary Joffe is going to join us talking about infrastructure and the pipe dream of infrastructure that sort of metamorphosizes by itself. But no, it doesn't. It takes an awful lot of planning and hard work. And so we'll talk about that. And then a company that finally, I've been looking for one of these for ages, a South African business that takes rooibos tea and adds flavors to it and really upgrades it, beneficiates it, if you will. And I found one up the west coast of South Africa the other day. Looking forward to chatting to Carmian Tea this evening. Play the Brutal Biz Quiz and between 7 and 8. Among the interviews that we will be sharing with you this evening is the discussion we had with Ian Furr, the founder of Sorbet, about his new book called Cultureneering. He is such an incredible individual, is Ian Furr. And I'm looking forward to bringing you that discussion once again between 7 and 8. Plus a whole lot more. Welcome to The Money Show.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
South Africa, not the only country trying to get rid of an airline. We know the government has agreed to sell SAA or a controlling stake in SAA to the Takenda consortium. They've gone incredibly quiet, but nothing to suggest that things are going awry in terms of that deal. But I see today that Air India, also another loss-making national carrier, has been sold to the Tata Group. It is India's biggest conglomerate. They export their cars to South Africa, of course. And government is selling the company, which was to Tata for $2.4 billion. So they're actually getting some money for their stake in the business of the national carrier. I'm not sure South Africa will get a penny for its and will be left with a bunch of liabilities too. What's interesting about this one, though, is that the Tata Group actually founded the airline in 1932 and it was taken over by the Indian government in 1953. Things go full circle, of course, because the government worked out it wasn't any good at running the airline. It had racked up $9.5 billion in losses. And as a result, they're saying to the Tata Group, please, can you have it back? And the Tatas, of course, greeting it with open arms. Great celebrations in the world of the Tatas. If you look at their Twitter feeds, people, they are very, very excited. Well, the tide turning against one of our more plentiful commodities, and that's coal. We've got millions of tons of quite accessible coal not far beneath the surface of large parts of South Africa, but much of it is likely to stay there forever, as the mood towards coal as an acceptable source of energy is changing. Even China's promising to cut carbon emissions to zero by 2060. America rejoining the Paris Trade Climate Agreement after Donald Trump took them out. Joe Biden's taken them back in again. And in South Africa, it's hard to find anybody willing to pay for any new coal projects. Coal is commodity non grata, if you like. Jesse Burton is Senior Associate at E3G and Energy Systems Researcher at UCT. Talk to me about the state of coal globally, and then specifically, if you would, Jesse, in South Africa.
Good evening, Bruce. Thanks so much for having me tonight. So the state of coal. Well, I think what we've seen over the last few years is that it's kind of two main things. So three, in fact. First of all, the economics of coal have really shifted very dramatically in the last 5 years. So you've gone from a situation of cheap coal being built all around the world to a situation where the pipeline of new coal plants has actually shrunk by 76%. So there are very few planned coal plants left in the world, partially because of the poorer economics. You're also seeing a lot of impetus around climate action and climate ambition. So in 2015, the Paris Climate Agreement was signed. And increasingly, you know, as we see bigger and bigger impacts happening, more droughts, more floods, et cetera, it's really driving home to people how important it is that we limit climate change to below 1.5 degrees. That's kind of the big target of Paris. And those two things are combining a lot to prevent the pipeline, kind of new coal plants really expanding. Then at the same time, you're seeing impetus around especially air pollution, both internationally and in South Africa, which is really getting a lot of countries to talk more and more about retiring older coal plants faster. And of course, climate change will also have a role there, because what we know from kind of the global modeling is you need to phase out coal by around 2040 in the world for power. How's this played out in South Africa is actually really simple. So we've gone from a situation where there were lots of planned coal plants a couple of years ago to a situation where we only really have one left still, and that's the Messina Mercado SEZ, you know, this Limpopo plant. And there's 1.5 gigawatts of new coal plants in the Integrated Resource Plan 2019, you know, our power plan. But it's very unlikely that that's going to be built, because it just doesn't really make economic sense anymore. And South Africa's kind of committing to more ambitious climate targets going into the future.
I mean, that's all really good news, unless you, of course, own a coal mine, in which case you are sitting on an asset that is, you're not going to get additional funding for into the future. You're not going to be able to expand. You're not going to be able to grow. We've seen Anglo's offload its coal mines recently, its coal operations, into an empowerment business. Are people who are in the coal business doomed, or do they have a runway to still exploit the resource for the foreseeable future?
Well, exactly. So I wouldn't say they're doomed. I think we've got quite a runway. I mean, no one's talking about shutting coal tomorrow. I know Minister Mantashe is always nervously talking about economic suicide and this kind of thing. But what we're really talking about is a slow decline of coal from today to 2040. And this is recognized by coal mining companies. So Anglo spun out Thungela, but you've also seen South 32 shift their assets and sell them onto Seriti. A couple of years ago, Anglo sold their Eskom mines also to Seriti. So a lot of these big diversified miners are getting out, and they're doing it for two reasons. It's not just because of the reputational issues and wanting to kind of decarbon their portfolios. It's also because they couldn't make the economics necessarily work. They couldn't make the political relationships with Eskom work. Anglo said that very explicitly. So I think like what we should be thinking about here is really two things. In a place like Mpumalanga, which has an incredible concentration of coal dependency, some of those municipalities like Amalahleni, 25% of employment is in coal mining, almost half of the town's GDP is related to coal. You have to really start thinking now about the diversification strategy for the next 20 years. Eskom are already doing this with some of their coal-fired power plants. They're talking about repowering and they're talking about repurposing them, and they're thinking about new business models for that region. But doing this in coal mining is really important. That's where a lot more of the jobs are. If you don't close mines responsibly, you end up with huge impacts on water, on degraded land, you know, which impacts the livelihood opportunities for people in the region into the future. And we've got to start doing that now, because it takes a long time to build new industries. It doesn't happen overnight. No.
No, absolutely. I mean, that transition, though, to cleaner energy, we are in a state of emergency. I observed earlier this week that South Africa's power demand and supply were very, very small. And then we had the announcement of 2 days of load shedding last night and tonight. And I've just seen a statement published by Eskom this evening saying in order to continue replenishing the emergency generation reserves and address additional risks, stage two load shedding extended until Thursday. So 9 p.m. till 5 a.m. every day until Thursday next week. That is the plan at this stage. We know often that can be extended. Because the coal power plants are old, dare I use the term buggered, but I think that is the technical term for many of our 40-year-old on average power stations.
That's a much politer word than I would have used, Chris. Exactly. So we typically have about 15 gigawatts of 40 gigawatts of coal plants not running. They're old. They've been under-maintained. They're getting often the wrong kind of coal going into power plants, because there's kind of a frantic attempt to get coal to where it needs to be in any minute. And so a lot of this kind of stress and fear about coal phase out, I think, is a little bit misguided. I mean, it's not unfounded, right? If you don't plan, people do lose their jobs and they lose their livelihoods. But actually what we need right now is to build 5 gigawatts of wind and solar just to meet demand. Then we need to build on top of that new capacity to replace the coal plants that are retiring because they're very old and we've been planning for them to close for many years. And some of the work that we and others have been done have shown, you know, you need to build something like 15 to 30 gigawatts of more wind and solar than is currently planned for in the integrated resource plan by 2030. That also helps us to achieve our Paris targets, our climate change mitigation targets. And it has huge economic spin-offs in terms of localization opportunities, you know, new job creation and that kind of thing. Plus, most importantly, it secures you energy supply. And that's really the biggest challenge to a kind of post-COVID recovery for the economy, I think.
Is there a future worth contemplating where we start using the equivalent of autocatalytic converters that are affordable on filthy power stations and actually make it possible to exploit a plentiful resource, which is coal? It is a resource. It is filthy. It's just the way in which we choose to utilize it, perhaps, that could improve. Or is that a bit of a pipe dream? Is it becoming sub-economic to even consider that?
So it's sub-economic even just to build new coal plants that don't have what's called carbon capture and storage, CCS technology attached to them. And that was already when the coal IPP program happened a few years ago. We could already see if you built those new coal plants instead of wind and solar, kind of a least cost energy electricity future, it would cost consumers more than 20 billion rand extra. Now, if you want to make them clean coal, in inverted commas, it uses a lot of the plant's energy. You have to put more coal in. You have to actually store that CO2 and transport it somewhere and put it underground. Very, very costly. Even not accounting for all of those costs, though, just putting that capture technology on means you're looking at around 2 rand per unit of electricity that comes out of a plant like that. Those are the DMRE's own numbers. We also did some work at UCT a few years ago saying, look, what if we needed a high coal future, right? We're a coal economy. It's been the backbone of industrialization. So let's model what happens if you build more coal. And what happens is that you save some jobs in the mining sector, but you destroy jobs everywhere else in the economy because electricity becomes so much more expensive.
Jesse, what a fabulous explanation for us this evening. Thank you very much for coming through and sharing for us with us this evening. Jesse Burton, Senior Associate at E3G and Energy Systems Researcher at UCT.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
And so much of what we're talking about goes to the core of infrastructure development, something we talk about an awful lot. And then we have meetings about it and then conferences about it. And then we gather and we discuss it further. And then we have meetings and we discuss it. And lots of jaw. Hilary Joffe, editor-at-large at Business Day, who's written a fabulous column in Business Day today about infrastructure-led recovery, meaning investment in infrastructure. The last time there was any meaningful infrastructure development in South Africa, you say, was what, back in the days of Jacob Zuma?
Before Jacob Zuma, no. In the first decade of democracy, we had lots of infrastructure. We had lots of public-private partnerships, Bruce. And then it all kind of tailed off. We've actually not had, in fact, even investment spending in real inflation-adjusted terms has been falling since 2015. We have not had investment, never mind infrastructure investment, growing in real terms since then. So it's a drought of investment, and we have for so long been talking about the need to build infrastructure to stimulate the economy in the short term, but also to enable it to grow faster and more sustainably in the long term. And we've been talking about this forever. And in the past year or two, President Ramaphosa has made infrastructure-led growth a kind of a plank of his economic policy. And we have the infrastructure office in the presidency. We have the infrastructure fund in the Development Bank of South Africa. And we have now this week had infrastructure symposium number 2 to pitch 55 more projects on top of the 62 projects they pitched a year ago. But if you look at the numbers, the infrastructure is not happening.
So what is holding it back? I mean, there's lots of talk of public-private partnerships, and we know they've worked in the past, yet government developed an allergy toward allowing the private sector to muscle in on its turf, and we can only surmise as to the reasons behind that. Possibly there was a level of corruption, the enrichment of the private sector at the expense of the way taxpayers' money was spent, or simply it was a corruption drive. I don't know. Perhaps you could provide some further insight.
I think there is no lack of finance or willingness in the private sector. Most private sector financiers would love to be financing infrastructure. It's exactly the kind of project that everyone's looking for. And we're not talking little bits of publicly funded social infrastructure like, you know, rural roads, important as that is, which only the government can really fund. We're talking about big transformative sort of infrastructure projects in some of the really important sectors of the economy where we need ports and railways and energy systems and water systems to work. The private sector is really keen to fund that and take the burden off the state and to go into partnerships with the public sector. I think the problem is not a willingness on the government side either. I think they now are really keen to do that. But the problems are within the state of the state itself, really. Very, very weak capacity within departments at provincial, at national, at local level, so that even the preparation of these projects to make them bankable and get them to market is poor, and they just don't fly. Sort of vested interests within the state and the whole regulatory framework, which is either unclear or unfriendly. So you're not going to get any more toll roads until government makes up its mind about whether it's willing to see tolls again.
So how do we break the deadlock, Hillary? I mean, does anybody have an answer as to how you break the deadlock? Because, I mean, I speak to people in the private sector that say, make it bankable, make it possible for us to get a return, make a return clear, give us the best possible guarantees that you can in terms of the future of our investments. And we are there. We are keen to do it. Porsche Derby wants 100 billion rand for ports. Banks are very willing to sink 100 billion rand into ports, but they must be guaranteed some sort of guaranteed return over a period of time.
Yes, and Porsche Derby must bring those projects to market. I think that's so I think it's not that there's not a willingness, it's just this glacial pace at which everything happens in government. And it's partly a lack of capacity. It's partly government tying itself up in regulatory knots of the time. And also the vested interests jumping up and down. And so Porsche Derby at Transnet is a really important example, because we need road and rail, we need rail and port infrastructure really desperately. Our logistics are quite dysfunctional. And so they've announced it, and I'm sure they talk about it at conferences, but I think Transnet needs to make it happen, and it needs to be willing to let go and let the private sector come in and do things in a sort of commercial sort of way.
We can't build bridges anywhere else, but have we bridged the ideological chasm that needs to be bridged? Because often that has been such an issue that has held us back for so long. Have we bridged the ideological chasm? Because then we can start dealing with real problems.
I think if nothing else, the finances of the country have forced some bridging of the ideological chasm. The public sector, the government doesn't have the money to finance these things. It has to rely on the private sector. Whether it's processed the fact that if you want private sector money, you have to do it to some extent on private sector terms is a question. I think it may be less an ideological divide in some cases than vested interests clinging onto it. And I think the other thing which often also holds these projects back is that the government sort of overloads them with objectives. You can't just build infrastructure in the best optimal way, in a way that the private sector can finance, make them bankable. You've also got to overload it with all sorts of objectives. Particular groups have got to benefit, yeah. And it's got to be localized, and it's got to be this, and it's got to be that. And you sort of, at some point, have to make up your mind about what your priorities are. Do we need working ports, or do we need kind of all these wasted interests to benefit? So I think someone has got to cut through all of that. And the infrastructure office in the presidency, which is called Infrastructure South Africa, was supposed to do that, both to help government departments with preparing the projects and getting them to market. And also it should, in theory, have the authority of the president to cut through some of these blockages
is a good word. Hilary Joffe, thank you. Editor at Business Day. Editor at large at Business Day.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
On to David Peacock, Portfolio Manager at Sunlum Private Investments. The jobs numbers, we look at these on a regular basis in the United States, and their problem is they are creating hundreds of thousands of jobs, just not as many as the market is anticipating they will create. 194,000 last month, and the unemployment rate below 5%, that's also good, but not as good as expected, and that's always the thing that makes markets run amok a little bit, David.
Yeah, good evening, Bruce. It is an interesting one because effectively those numbers came out at 150,000 today. The expectation was 500,000. I'm not exactly sure after the numbers that you spoke about from the previous reporting period was such a significant increase. But ultimately, in terms of that, Bruce, as you know, in the last while, bad news is good news. So from that perspective, it tends to be the sort of view that, you know, the discussion on tapering in the United States and reducing the stimulus that's going into the economy is possibly, you know, some way off at this stage. So, you know, I think, you know, looking at U.S. markets at the moment, I mean, the Dow's basically flat at this stage. The S&P is very, very marginally flat. So from that perspective, you know, I would say to you it's probably good news on the basis that, you know, the stimulus in the economy is going to continue for some time still.
And that's, I mean, again, it's supportive of markets. It's then we'll see the dollar soften a little bit, and that'll be supportive of the rand for a while at least. I mean, that's the way it usually plays out.
Yeah, that is true. Obviously, you know, in terms of the structure of our economy in the last year, the fact that, you know, being a very strong resources company or country, you know, that and our exports and hardly importing anything has been very supportive of the currency in the last while. But yes, I would agree. And I think what you would probably get is a bit more stability in the rand, you know, and just sort of, you know, touching on that particular area as well. I mean, we've seen commodity prices firming quite aggressively during the course of today. I mean, platinum is currently up 4%, palladium up almost 6%. You know, oil price was $83 just a while ago. West Texas, you know, breached the $80 a barrel for the first time since, I think, 2014, around that level, that sort of time. So, that should be quite positive for the South African economy. And on the back of that, we saw resources sector up sort of 2.7% on the day, Bruce.
Yeah, absolutely huge. I mean, platinum shares, which have been the sort of bedrock, if you like, if I'm not mixing mining metaphors, of the South African recovery this year, and have certainly been huge income earners for the state in terms of taxes and royalties. Without this platinum sector and without the boom in the platinum sector that we've enjoyed, I think we'd be in a whole lot more trouble. The outlook for the platinum sector, therefore, is an important one. And it looked like the story was beginning to change, but suddenly this week something has ignited the flare beneath the platinum sector once more. Is there a particular reason?
Yeah, Bruce, so I would say to you that what has come through in literally today was obviously the Chinese markets have been closed for some time, and they reopened today. So we've had quite a strong kicker there. And added to that, you know, there was some information out sort of later on in the day, just in terms of China giving the authority to coal mines to expand their production aggressively. I think it was about 100 million tons is what they're looking to increase coal production locally with, really on the basis that 60% of China's economy is fueled by coal. And in spite of them, you know, looking to be carbon neutral by sort of 2060, you know, clearly the impact that's had on that economy, you've seen in the recent while in terms of slowing GDP expectations. And I would say that, you know, with this this increase in production of coal locally, you know, I think you'll see quite a nice rebound in those economies and or in that economy, and therefore the demand for commodities, I think, will continue to be fairly strong.
David Peacock, Portfolio Manager at Sanlam Private Investments.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
This is The Money Show. I'm Bruce Whitfield. And coming up on the next Money Show, Conrad Koch is bringing his friend Chester Missing for Other People's Money. Try and see whether or not we can corral those two. Warren Ingram on his brand new book, which I have in my grubby little paws, Global Investing Made Easy. Plus, we'll be taking a seat in the Lexus LS500 and talking about opulence, talking about comfort, and talking about style on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
The Friday File.
The Friday File.
Before we get to the Friday File, I must warn you of something I think is a scam. I think it's a scam because what it's purporting to be is not true. I got an email today claiming to be from Netflix to say your subscription has been expired. That's the first problem. There's a grammatical error. We have attempted to authorize your payment for next billing cycle of your subscription without success. Therefore, we had to suspend it. Renewable of monthly subscription. And then it's given me my email address. It gives me an expiration date of today. And it says, obviously, we would love to see you again. Update the expiration date and CVV as soon as possible so that you can continue your favorite series without interruption. Click update my subscription to renew now. So what do you think I did? I switched on my Netflix and it was still working. And then I went and I Googled, what does a Netflix expiry look like? And a couple of versions of that, clumsily worded ideas. And then it says, well, log on to your Netflix account and you can see it. And so I logged on to my Netflix account, which told me my subscription was still active. It told me, gave me the credit card number, which is still valid. And so this is very clearly a scam. And it came from a weird email address in New Zealand, of all places. New Zealand? Too much lockdown in New Zealand. That's where the email address was. Came close to getting scammed today because your first reaction is, oh, I better just deal with it quickly. Clearly, the credit card that I'd subscribed on has expired and, you know, whatever the case might be. And then you just pause to reflect for a moment. You go, hold on a second. Hold on. And luckily I double checked. So please be warned, there are lots of scamsters. And I feel quite smug, a little bit proud of myself. I've also long been bemoaning the lack of beneficiation of South African raw materials. We have so much really cool stuff in South Africa. The only thing we've really beneficiated with any degree of success over many years is coal. And that's not been good for the economy because it's made everything filthy. Very few people beneficiate our diamonds adequately, our platinum's resources adequately, our gold resources adequately. And it frustrates me when I see German tea bags in my local spa that have got rooibos as a base with all kinds of marvelous flavors and additions, because most of our rooibos exports go out the country in bulk. And yes, the guys at Boss Tea have done a good job of raising the profile and adding value to rooibos. But recently, I took a road trip along the beautiful N7 Highway. It really is a magnificent road with recent upgrades along the west coast. And near Citrusdal, I found a place called Picnicker Kloof, which is a wine estate. And in there, this huge array of, and I can't even pronounce it, I think it's Carmine, or is it Carmien? Tea. Lizay Dupria is the daughter of Miki Mouton, who is the founder and managing director of Carmien Tea. The company is a family-run business. Just give me a pronunciation guide there quickly, Lizay. Is it Carmien or Carmine?
It's Carmine.
Carmine, because it's got a little like-y thing on the E, and that just confused the living daylights out of me. How did it all begin? How did your mother, Minky, get started in the rooibos business?
Okay, so it was shortly after the deregulation of the agricultural industry of the One Channel Marketing Boards that she decided that it's a good idea to start exporting rooibos tea. And obviously due to its magnificent health benefits, being naturally caffeine-free, she thought that there's just so much more that you can do with the product. So that's when she decided to travel internationally, go see major international tea importing companies. And she there saw this magnificent variety of teas with flavors and blends, and thought that it would be great to actually bring that back home and start a Rooibos tea brand that has this variety of products that we didn't find back then in South Africa. So yes, so the name Carmine is actually a combination of her name, Minky, and her twin sister, Carmen Nels, the food editor of, used to be the food editor of You. And she thought that's a good connection to the food industry as well. And Carmine actually means red, so very suitable for Rooibos. So she started it about 20 years ago.
And what sort of experience did she have? I mean, did she have Rooibos in her blood? Did she grow up in the Citrusdal area, which is, you know, got lots of wild Rooibos growing in amongst the other fynbos?
Yeah, so she grew up on a farm that where Rooibos tea was also grown. So she definitely had it in her blood. She knew the product very well. So Rooibos tea obviously only grows in that region, the only place in the world where it grows. This year, Rooibos was actually accredited by the European Union as a GI certified product, the first in Africa. So Citrusdal is the gateway to the Rooibos tea region. So she lived there and she grew up on the farm where it was grown. Her background was actually in finance, and she was still at that stage involved in the citrus side of the business. So that's when she decided to quit that side of the family business and start Carmine tea.
And then you mentioned that Rooibos was once regulated. Did that mean that anybody who grew Rooibos then had to sell it through a fixed cooperative system? How did that work?
Yes, exactly. I think all the agricultural products used to go through a one-channel marketing board. So the same applied for Rooibos. Then the Rooibos Agricultural One-Channel Marketing Board was actually privatized also. And then, farmers like ourselves could start selling Rooibos tea internationally directly. So, that opened great doors, and she saw that potential, and that's when she started to export Rooibos.
So lots of farmers, wine farmers, for example, don't own the land. They don't produce their own grapes. They might buy in grapes. They have certain suppliers, and they produce their own wine based on the grapes that they buy in. Do you grow all of your own Rooibos, or do you buy from other producers?
So we grow a big portion of the Rooibos that we sell. The whole model of the Carmine tea brand and the business model is based on supplying our customers Rooibos directly from the farm, as close as possible to the source. So within our own family businesses, we produce about 20% of the Rooibos that we sell, and the rest we source from other Rooibos tea producers from different regions. In that 70,000 hectares where Rooibos is grown.
How many tons of Rooibos do you process every year?
Carmine tea does about 2,500 tons to 3,000 tons. So, and the industry is about 20,000 tons, of which 50% is consumed locally. Carmine exports more than 98% of our product.
And where is your big market? I mean, where is this market? Because, frankly, until I took a drive up the West Coast and went to, I think it was Pieterskloof outside Citrusdal, I hadn't seen your product before, I'm ashamed to say. But that's because you only care about foreigners.
No, we don't only care about foreigners. So the big market for us is in Europe. So mostly Germany, Netherlands, UK, and then also the Far East. Japan is quite a big market for us. We export our own Carmine products to the Far East and the Middle East as well. So and that's continuing to grow. And then the US is starting, but that's still a difficult market to get into.
But it's amazing. I mean, so you process more than 10% of all of the Rooibos tea produced in South Africa at 2,500 tons. 98% of that is exported. Is it exported in a finished product, in the little boxes, the little tea boxes wrapped in cellophane that I saw on the shelves?
No, we wish it was. Our vision is definitely to do more value-added product on this side, create more jobs. Also the processing facility that we did put up ourselves in 2006 is 50% owned by the farm workers. So for us, it's about making a difference in the community and on ground level as well. But yeah, from there, we process it in our exclusive facility.
Okay, so most of it is a bulk export. Most of it goes out in big containers. So the value add stuff, the pretty stuff, the floral berry and the citrus chai and the masala, which is delicious, and the buchu, which I've got to get my head around still. Those flavored teas, those finely flavored teas, those beautifully put together teas, that is, I'm sure, a minority of production. And that is where the value add is and where the margin is for the future.
Yes, exactly. So we still do majority of our volume in bulk, but our value-added product is definitely growing. We see a massive growth in value-added product, especially going out to the Far East. We do that either under our own Carmen brand, or we also back private label for other international brands. So, but yeah, we continuously expanding our Rebels Tea range. Our consumers in South Africa, that's loyal followers of Carmen, knows that we're known for our innovation. Every year we bring out a new Rebels Tea blend. And we're starting to move away from purely flavored Rebels and more towards functional teas. Actually, this last week we launched a Rebels with CBD, which is called Calm. And we also launched a Boost with added vitamin C. So the innovation just continues.
What a lovely story, and thank you for sharing it with us this evening. I'm so glad I managed to stumble across you, Lise Depria, who is the marketing director and the daughter of the founder of Carmen Tea. The founder of Carmen Tea is Minky Mouton, the founder, and it's a family business, fabulous family business, and they are responsible for exports of more than 10% of South Africa's rooibos, and more of it is in the pretty boxes and stuff. Look out for it. It's really good. Penelope Langton on my Twitter account is telling me that Carmen Tea is the best. I bought some and thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was brilliant. Coming up in a moment, the Brutal Biz Quiz. We'd like you to play, if you wouldn't mind too much. It requires you. It needs you. I need you. You need to play. First question. It's a yes or no question. So you've got a good 50-50 chance of getting it right. Is Tina Turner married to Ted Turner, the founder of CNN? Is Tina Turner, she's the best, you know, only the best. She's better than all the rest. Married to Ted Turner, the founder of CNN. That is the first question in tonight's Brutal Biz Quiz. All you have to do is give us a call on 021-446-0567, 011-883-0702. A simple yes or no answer. Is Tina Turner married to Ted Turner, the founder of CNN? Give us a call right now on those numbers and play the Brutal Biz Quiz.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
Brutal Biz Quiz this evening. No, it doesn't count if you WhatsApp me directly to my phone. It doesn't count. You have to play the game to be in the game. Dares in Johannesburg, I'd like to know, is Tina Turner married to Ted Turner, the founder of CNN?
It's DEV, and no, she's not married to Ted Turner.
You're absolutely right on that one. He is married to Jane Fonda. She, Tina Turner, used to be married to Ike Turner. And this week, she joined the likes of Bob Dylan and Stevie Nicks, who've sold their catalogues, and she sold 6 decades worth of music. She'll be okay. What is the name of the recent data leak, which is exposing the personal financial affairs of global leaders and business people, people who are putting money into tax havens? They are called the What Papers, Des?
Oh, I read it in the paper the other day. No, I forgot.
If this was a box, it would be opened by this person. Thank you, Dares. Maditsi and Mamelodi. Maditsi, if this was a box, it would be opened by this person. What is the name of the recent data leak which shows how the rich evade paying taxes?
Pandora.
The Pandora paper. Pandora's box. That's what's been opened. 12 million documents reveals all kinds of hidden assets all over the world, including people like Uhuru Kenyatta, Shakira. She's in Pandora's box, and so's the UK Prime Minister, former UK Prime Minister, Tony Blair. Which South African company has a great big fat yellow umbrella as its logo?
Santam.
Ooh, you paused, my Dietzi. They were thinking, my goodness me, what will that marketing spend? Absolutely. George, give me a round of applause. Thank you, George. According to the company, the umbrella symbolizes the all-encompassing cover and peace of mind, but my Africa Hotels and Stellenbosch Kitchen had to go to court to get their payments, and they got them finally yesterday after 18 months of wrangling. What would we call a person who exposes or discloses information to the public or some high authority about internal wrongdoing? These are, and you can't say Mandy Wiener's friends, because she has lots of friends who do this kind of thing. She's even written a book with this title. What do we call somebody who exposes foul deeds inside a company or inside a political structure?
Whistleblower.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then finally, True or false? Last question. Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez is proposing to pay 4,300 rand to young people under 35 to move out of their family home.
True.
It's absolutely true, my dear. See, well done to you. Congratulations. So many households, the parents would pay the child 4,300 rand to move out of the family home. Not everybody, of course, can afford it. And that's been the problem in places like Spain, where youth unemployment actually is pretty high. Not as bad and high as South Africa's youth unemployment, but it's pretty high by global standards. And now what the government there is doing is making it easier for young Spaniards who don't earn very much to go out and find a home of their own. And anybody between age of 18 to 35 who earns less than the equivalent of 400,000 rand a year will be paid about 4,300 rand a month to put toward their rent. And so the Prime Minister says that that housing is a grave problem, and the BBC is reporting a benefit will be given for up to 2 years as part of a broader housing package. What a wonderful, empowering move that is by Spain. Coming up in the next hour, we are going to be bringing you some of the best bits of The Money Show from the week that has been. That includes part of that fantastic discussion that we had with the founder of Sorbet, Ian Fur, but also in there is the Vice Chancellor of UCT, Mamogeti Pakeng, talking about the incredible initiatives that they are launching, that they are driving. And amongst those initiatives, of course, is this fabulous new UCT online school, which is powered by the Valencia Institute. So there's lots to learn this evening still here on The Money Show. Please do stay tuned. Coming up after Eyewitness News.